Everything Arty Show, every Thursday from 8 till 9 on Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM. That's the Anything Arty Show, sponsored by the Artist Goldsmith Studio Connections on Iroa. Call in to see Christine's latest designs or phone 372 7809 to discuss a commission.
Yes, indeed, and welcome along again on this Thursday evening to the Anything Artist Show here on Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM. And you will be surprised to hear we have another action-packed show tonight, and basically we're going to be doing four things. We've got a I mentioned the other week about a World Watch segment that I was keen to put into the show, so we're going to have our first World Watch segment tonight, and we'll be scooting up to Berlin for that. More about that in a moment. We have an interview with author Stefan Hessel. Now, you may have heard of Stefan Hessel's, you may even have a copy of his current book, which is Taking the World by Storm. You may have seen his name in the local papers in reference to an event that's happening at Tivoli on Saturday in commemoration of Basil Holmes. But I'll say more about that a little bit later on. But we have an interview with the author, Stefan Hessel, which is a fascinating interview. And of course, we have our final episode of Jaws. Dun, 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 dun. This has been a cracker, this particular serialization. I've enjoyed it. So we have the final one coming up. Final episode. And also a quick look at some of the things that will be happening around the island over the weekend and beyond, because there's plenty on. And of course, you can always catch up with everything that's happening in our two local newspapers, who are I've got great coverage. So that's of course the Gulf News and Waiheke Marketplace. Plenty of news about art and arty stuff happening in there. But now to World Watch. One of the things I wanted to do with the show was just sort of look at glimpses of life beyond our island, and that's both this little island that we're on and the big island that we're part of. And look at what's happening in other places around the world. And I managed to have a conversation with somebody who is familiar to listeners of Waiheke Radio, who's currently living up in Berlin, just to get a snap of a little bit of what life is like there on an everyday basis. And we picked the topic of transport to have a conversation about, amongst other things, because this particular person was explaining to me some of the enjoyable aspects of transport in and around the city they're in, but also on a recent trip to London, experience up there as well. So the person we're going to be hearing from is none other than Sophie Jo Porton, aka Sojo, who will be known to, as I say, a number of listeners and certainly a number of us here at the station for the time that she was on air, and hopefully will be on air again. So what we're going to do is just head up to Berlin and just have a conversation I had earlier this morning with Sojo about what life is like up in that part of the world for our first World Watch.
At the moment, it's about 9 o'clock in the morning, I think, your time. Oh, no, in the evening, sorry. You're on night time there, of course. We're on morning over here.
Sure.
Now, tell me, first of all, and your following of listeners, which you do have at Waiheke Radio, by the way, what took you to Berlin?
Okay, well, I mean, I often talk about it on the radio as well, and I mean, those who knew me, me and my partner Richard, he was a chef at Cable Bay on Waiheke for 2 years, and basically his visa was up, and I graduated from university, and we both thought, let's go overseas, it's a perfect opportunity to do it. So we kind of ambled around Germany a little bit, and we've been in Berlin for the last year.
Fantastic. And I understand that you may not be staying in Berlin much longer, is that right?
Well, I tried and fought to the death pretty much to try and stay here, but German bureaucracy is pretty rough. I actually had to wait for 5 months for my visa application to be denied. So we thought, let's go home, and Richard got his 2-year visa within 2 weeks of applying for it. So it was a bit of fate, really. So we're very looking forward to coming home in mid-December.
Cool, all right, and then start again. Have a consider where else in the world you may end up, I guess.
Well, exactly. We thought, you know, being away for 2 years, and I mean, family and friends in New Zealand is such a huge support system to both of us, and 2 years is quite long, and not only that, I really don't want to do a third winter in Germany.
Right.
As a Winky Czech, you know, that's soul-destroying, I tell you.
Yeah, must be, because what would be, you would get, snow wouldn't be unusual in the midst of the city, I guess, during Christmas.
Yeah, it's really crazy. I mean, there's snow, and then there's snow, and then there's blizzards. Like, it actually can be quite debilitating at sometimes, and it makes it really tricky to get around. I mean, the public transport system here is so great that you don't really need a car, but either which way, the snow is a killer. It really makes life that much harder.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, you'll be coming back to World Cup country, so that'll be fantastic. We'll look forward to... it's a very nervous weekend. Now,
it's going to be good. We'll be at the pub at 9 o'clock on Sunday.
Oh, is there a big following over there for it? Biggish?
Not huge, but I mean, if you go to like the international hostels, like I bumped into a guy that I worked with like years ago in a former life almost. I bumped into him at the pub, and he's living in London, and he said to me, "Oh, you know, don't be too surprised. The Kiwis and the Aussies like to congregate together. I'm always bumping into people, and it's, I mean, there's a good Kiwi following."
Yeah.
And it's a big rugby following as well. It's been really fun. See, for the morning part, I mean, getting up at 8, 9
and
going to the pub,
then
you can't not have beer. Like,
Brilliant, brilliant. Now, there was a number of things on this little World Watch segment that I've been playing with that you and I have been emailing about in terms of your observations of life in Berlin, life in Germany, I guess, and also because you do zip across to London and the UK. I think you were there reasonably recently too. And you had a big celebration for your birthday, by the way. So so on behalf of everyone at the station, happy birthday for you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it was a good one. Quarter century, it was a bit of a big one. So, I mean, it was great. It was lots of fun, so thanks for that.
Cool. Now, one of the sort of themes that I thought we'd have a conversation about was around transport. Because at the time of our initial conversations, it was when we were having all sorts of uproar over here about the start of the World Cup. The hassles around moving around, and people decrying that the cup's going to be a disaster because you can't get from A to B because of the trains and everything.
And it was pretty tragic.
Yeah,
from what I read from the side of the world, it wasn't the best. Let's say that.
No, it wasn't. And then subsequently, as you wouldn't be surprised, absolutely everything's been fine. So it was like that one-off occasion that everybody says, that's it, the world's coming to an end, but we seem to be all right and get through it all. But our, you know, our transport system very well, of course, both on the island and around the city.
Yep.
And it seems to be, we seem to be fortunate, I think, from what you tell me about the transport system over there. It seems to be a little bit different. How does it work for you guys?
It's basically worlds apart, to be honest. I mean, when I was in New Zealand, especially Waiheke, you know, I was commuting to uni every day. I mean, lots of people do the commute as well. But, I mean, you're really almost beyond spoiled for choice here in Berlin. I mean, unless I think 99.99% of my friends don't own a car. You just don't need it. I mean, you have so many things available to you. You've got the underground, the U-Bahn, you've got the overground, the S-Bahn, you've got sort of intercity regional trains, which are high-speed ones, which are really great. Then on the top line of it all, then you've got buses, you've got trams, and they're spread out enough that you can get anywhere. Like, wherever you live, there's a bus stop, there's a metro station very close to you, and it's amazing. Like, I don't know how I'm going to cope when I get back to New Zealand. My expectations are so high. The bar's been risen a lot.
It's interesting. In a number of European cities, just as you mentioned about, there's usually... You don't have to walk far from your front door before you can find either, as you say, an underground system, a bus system, some sort of a system of public transport that just means, as you said before, that cars you don't need. It's a lot more difficult in a lot of European cities anyway, just because of the sheer number of people living in city centres to park, etc. But just that it's almost like, why would you bother when, for a relatively inexpensive price, and I'll just check on pricing in a moment, but you can get to where you need to go. And as you know, here the problems we have is, whilst there may be some some interesting bus systems. We have the couple of new different variations in the link system here at the moment. We get an inner and outer and a free round the city. But they don't extend out beyond the kind of immediate CBD type areas, so it becomes more and more difficult to have that network that you're talking about, where you can go virtually anywhere within the city confines. But within a time frame, I was looking at a schedule the other day, and it's like an hour between the buses that you might want to get to go to where you want to go to, and it's like it's just not a happening thing.
No. I mean, I think in the almost 2 years that we've lived in Germany, I think I've caught a taxi twice, only through necessity of, I can't sort of think of it off the top of my head right now, but I mean, for me, it's got to the point where I forgot what it feels like to sit in a car. Like when we at Richard's parents and we, you know, get driven to the supermarket, you know, after we get driven to the train station, it feels really twilight zone for me. I mean, I haven't driven for 2 years either. I don't have an international license, and I mean, one, I wouldn't want to. You've got these crazy drivers here, but it's just, it's insane. Like, you're just so spoiled that, I mean, to forget what a car feels like, you kind of
It does, doesn't it? Well, you better get used to it when you come back here, I tell you, because we just more and more cars all the time, more and more road systems all the time on the island. It's quite amazing, actually. Just the and again, big discussions about what are they doing to our grass verges and things on the island for the sake of the motor vehicle. So it's just, and of course, summer coming up, as you well know, it's just a huge influx of cars all over the place. So you'll be, you may or may not be surprised at the sheer volume of our beloved four-wheel drives, of course, that are still in the local papers about.
It's bound to happen. Every year it increases. And I mean, it's really sad when we do see the natural sand dunes and whatnot, you know, up at Onitangi or Oniroa, and, you know, they're slowly kind of getting withered away by it, you know, and it's sad.
Well, I would just to jump to that for a second, the Matiatia issues that you'll be familiar with, of course, it seems funny. You're so many thousands of miles away, but it's just like all these local issues that you're more.
I'm still here, you know, I still read the Gulf News online when I can, and no, it's always been home, no matter how far away I am.
That's lovely. On Matiatia at the moment, we've got the usual parking issues. We've got the left hand lane going to Matiatia. I'm not very good with north, south, east, west, so I have to go left, right, forward, backwards. Left-hand side going to Matiatia has been closed off, so they were doing some roadworks along resurfacing and stuff, and then decided that bank on the side of the road they deemed dangerous, so they said, right, we'll take all the parking away from there.
Well, you know, to be honest, I'm not that surprised. I mean, you know, you try to get there in winter, and when it's all kind of turning to mud, and there's, you know, so much volume going through, it was bound to happen, really. I mean, it's a shame, but... You know, I'm not all that surprised.
Yeah, and it's part of what you say about just the effects that it has on either sand dune areas or just earth. And of course, the ways our roads are done here anyway, just on all of that stuff. So we've got that combined with new... Oh, this was one that you would have caught up with probably, but the new parking meters we're getting down there as well. So,
I heard something about that. I haven't actually spoken to anyone about it, but I read something somewhere and wondered.
Well, apparently our help a pal scheme, where if you happen to come into the car park as I'm going out and I've got a few hours left on the ticket that might be of some use, you know, I might just give it to you, you know.
Sure.
Just to kind of help out, they've put the kiwash on that by bringing in meters that you put your license plate number in.
Oh my God!
Yeah, so your car's identified by the license plate number on the ticket, so you can't swap it with a pal to help them out on the way.
So easy. So
that's due in soon. Now tell me, how are people actually? We still have reasonably. I mean, our bus drivers on the island, particularly, are fantastic. People are still very friendly around the bus stops and things like that, and even on the buses, you get the occasional chat. It's different, of course, as you know, when you get into town, but in terms of the conversations on the buses. But what's it like for you, sort of moving around Berlin and stuff like that?
Well, I mean, the only kind of like interaction you really have with the sort of transport workers, shall we say, would be a bus driver. I mean, when you're on the tube, you know, you don't see the conductors or anything, but you know, you do interact with the bus drivers. And being a pretty bad German speaker. You know, it can be quite frustrating. You know, I've come across this time and time again where, you know, even though if I'm not pronouncing something entirely right, you know, I'll do my hands and feet signals. And they just shoot you down so badly. Like, you know, you're obviously in help of something and you're trying your very best to communicate with them. And, you know, the amount of times I've had someone going, "Was?" What? And I'm just, you know, quivering because, I mean, it's a pretty scary language as well. But, I mean, it's not like the same in New Zealand. And especially because I'm so used to it, every time I jump off a bus, I'd always, you know, wave my hand up and say, "Thanks, driver."
Yeah.
I got that, you know, within weeks because the looks that... Yeah, they would be like, "What is that crackhead doing?" And I mean, I had bus drivers kind of looking around at me being like, "What? Was?" It was quite bizarre. So, I mean, it's very kind of impersonal here. And when you do try to interact, or if you just need help, I mean, even at the main train stations, you know, if you go up and say, you know, introduce yourself, you know, my German isn't that good, you know, can you please help me? They're not very helpful.
That's amazing, yeah.
I mean, Germany has one of the worst customer service I've ever seen anywhere.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, it's really unhelpful. And it's, you know, when you're stuck somewhere and you know, you want to use the transport system and sometimes you just can't get any help, and it's a bit frustrating.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting because some countries, when you try and use the language, they're very appreciative of that. And they'll kind of help you out, and they think, "Oh, good on you for giving it a go."
Yeah, I'm going to try. You know, obviously she needs some help. Let's see what I can do. But no, there's no call for that here. You know, you kind of just see if they. I mean, sometimes they don't answer you. Sometimes they'll just swat you away. So you've got to kind of roll with the punches sometimes.
And as you say, it is a it's a harsh language to begin with. So you just add that with some tonality, and it can be quite a.
Exactly, and I mean, there's still, you know, like a lot of formalities, like with the words to use, and so, you know, you might say it how you think you know it to like a friend, but if it's an elder person, you know, they can get really offended by that.
Oh, right.
That's tricky.
Yeah, right, got you. Yeah, interesting, eh? And was it different in London when you zipped across there recently, or is that still fairly impersonal, or how's that?
Well, to be honest, we didn't actually use too much of the public transport. I found it, in my own opinion, I actually found it a bit of a step back from Germany. They had a completely different pay system, which was just, you know, not what I'm used to at the moment. And it didn't seem as cohesive and connected. It felt very far apart. And, you know, whereas here in Berlin, you know, you can get lost and walk a block and a half and you'll see an S or a U-Bahn station. Right. You know, whereas in London, we would be walking, we'd get lost all the time. And we wouldn't see any stations. And so it was definitely a different world in London. I didn't really like their transport system. I think I like the Berlin one best so far.
Cool. And what were you doing when you were in London? What was that? Was that just a quick trip?
I don't think I'll get in trouble for this. But basically, once my visa got denied, I was given about 3.5 weeks to exit the country, even though they'd strung me along for 5 months, you know, not giving me any answers. I wasn't allowed to work or anything. So I actually had to legally leave the country. I actually had to be signed out by immigration police at the border, at the airport. And fortunately, I had a pretty close friend over in London, and I checked out with the embassy, and they were like, "Well, look, there's a visa waiver agreement between Germany and New Zealand. You, by law, they have to let you in on a tourist visa."
Oh, wow.
So I jumped over the ditch for a bit, well, a bit of a bigger ditch maybe, but jumped over, saw my friend for a few quick days, and came back so that I could legally enter in as a tourist and not be charged as an overstayer and go down that road.
Got you. Yeah. No, you definitely don't want to go down there. What an amazing way to have to do it, eh? It's quite something.
Yeah, I mean, it was just ridiculous because they, you know, they said, "Oh, you know, it's going to take about 3 months for your work visa to process." And we were like, "Oh, okay, well, you know, that's a bit long." And then they actually strung it out for five and a half months. We were going in every week to immigration and being like, "This is ridiculous. What are we going to do?" And then they just turned around and said, "No, by the way, we had to leave in 3.5 weeks. And so we went back to try to fight it, and they gave me an extra month. It's pretty brutal, really. You know, that they had no compassion for the fact that for almost half a year I had to literally sit at home and wait for this result to come through, and then for them to turn around and say, actually, legally have to leave. And if I hadn't have got signed out by the immigration police, then, you know, that could have really affected me. I could essentially have been banned from Germany, and that would have affected any future transit travel. So it was, I mean, you know, I didn't really want to be an overstay anyway, but it was such drama. I really couldn't believe it. Hence why we're like, let's go home. And we were just completely shocked that from date of application and, you know, less than 2 weeks, Richard got a 2-year visa just like that.
That was amazing. So might you reapply from here, do you think? Would you give it another shot? Would you give Germany a second go?
Yes and no. I mean, it makes it really hard to come to Germany, let's say that. As a New Zealander, I have the right to complete a 1-year working holiday visa in 25 different countries, but it's kind of like a once-off pass. Once you use that, boom. If you want to come in and live and work, you pretty much have to have sponsorship, either, say, through marriage or through a work visa.
Gotcha.
I mean, it's really tricky, and to be honest, I'd probably give it a few years before I rethought that, because it's a huge, huge difference from New Zealand. And I mean, Germany's great. There's so many crazy things to go see and do, but New Zealand's home. And I hate the snow. Like, the snow's horrible.
Oh, superb. Well, look, we've been going for ages. Look, thanks for this. This has been fantastic. Have you got any particular any shout outs you'd like to do for anybody back in the island?
Oh, you put me on the spot. No, just everyone, all the Waiheke crew, all my family and friends over there who I've known the whole time and who have been so supportive of us, and obviously all the Waiheke Radio listeners, keep going strong.
Beautiful.
Support your community radio.
So, Joe, fantastic. Look, we look forward to catching up with you when you get back to the island, which is not that far away now. So thanks so much for this. And you'll be able to check out our new radio station.
I know. I've heard great things about the White House.
Beautiful. Views over Oneiroa Beach. It's just quite spectacular. It's amazing. So look, have a fantastic remaining time in Berlin, and we'll see you when you're back in the island.
Will do. Looking forward to it. Can't wait to get back on the airwaves.
Cool. See ya.
See ya.
Every Friday night, Waiheke Radio brings you the Darby and Joan Fan Club. Yeah, I'm Darby.
And I'm Joan. And each week we'll be bringing you sports news and reviews from Waiheke, New Zealand and internationally, with key interviews with local and national sports personalities.
A roundup of all the week's sport and a look ahead to the upcoming fixtures and events. All that and Joan's knitting report. It can't be ignored.
The Darby and Joan Fan Club every Friday, proudly sponsored by Barbizza, the barbecue pizza oven that rocks. To order yours now, go to barbizza.com.
Show every Thursday from 8 till 9 on Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM. That's the Anything Arty Show, sponsored by the Artist Goldsmith Studio Connections on Iroa. Call in to see Christine's latest designs or phone 372 7809 to discuss a commission.
Yes, indeed. And thank you very much to David and Christine, the Artist Goldsmith, for sponsoring the show and looking after us. You can always find them Studio Connections, Ocean View Road on Iroa, and I'm sure there'll be something enticing in the on display over this long weekend, so go in and check it out. And some other things while you're out and about, potentially over the weekend, there's lots of really interesting stuff happening from an arty perspective. At the Community Art Gallery, we've got the Walker and Hall winners,
that are on display up there. I went and had a look today. There's some fabulous pieces up there. Absolutely worth popping your head in the door and taking a walk around. Because they also have a bundle of stuff that's on a reduced price up there for a lot of ceramics and glassware and other really interesting, beautiful pieces too. So check that out over the weekend. My two favourites in the Walker and Hall exhibition up on the wall. One is by John Pulsari. And I talked a week or so ago about, maybe it was 2 weeks ago, about lithographs. This John Pulsari piece is an 8-colour stone lithograph. It's called Dead Blue Roller. And you may not be surprised by the title to know that the actual picture is of a dead blue roller, as in the bird roller. Now, it's an unusual thing, granted, to hang on your wall. It's a painting of, it's a lithograph of that, so it's not like a stuffed bird. It may be a bit unusual to hang on your wall, but I have to say, looking at, it's just exquisite. It's absolutely captivating in a, I'm not sure if it's in a bizarre way or not, but it's absolutely worth having a look at. The other one that's up there that I really enjoyed was by, I think this, I'm assuming this is the artist's name, Blue W. Black. It was a piece done on house paint and oil on paper. So if you think paper mache, in terms of from a texture perspective, you've potentially got, I may have done this incredible injustice, but you've pretty much got the kind of texture on the wall. It just stands out from the wall, something incredible. It's called Group Dynamics. It's just a stunning piece. It's well worth a look at. And also on there right now is something that we are so fortunate to have on this island. Now, even though I'm not a true art appreciator, the fact that this particular artist is on display on the island is phenomenal in itself. It's part of the Words on a Small Island Book Festival, excuse me, that's happening on November 4 to 6. And there's going to be, I'll be doing a particular piece about that next week about the book festival. So check that one out, because I had a conversation with Geraldine, the organiser, inspiration behind the festival. A great conversation, which I'll be playing next week. But a part of the festival is a floor talk by artist Ewan MacDonald. Now, Ewan was New Zealand born. It's said that he went to Australia. Rumour has it he was nicked by the Australians, but I don't think we're allowed to say that. But anyway, he ended up in Australia. He has won, of the three of Australia's top national prizes, he's won two and drawn one. To use a sports analogy, he's won two of them, and that was the Sulman and the Archibald awards, and he came runner-up in the Wynn prize. So he's done a clean sweep, as it were, over there. So it's just he's a phenomenal artist, and he's on display in our very own community art gallery. You've got to get in and just have a look at this guy's work. It's quite a unique style, to me anyway. It's quite a unique style in his particular exhibition he's got up there at the moment. Very, very striking. Absolutely worth a look, so get into there. Now, in the Toy Gallery in Ocean View Road, just as you walk, if you've been in Studio Connections, you just go a little bit past Studio Connections, same building, and you'll see Toy Gallery in there. Now, they've got a really interesting exhibition that's going on in there called The Art of Architecture. Now, again, you may remember maybe 2-3 weeks ago, we had a two-part conversation with the artist Goldsmith, the sponsor of our show, about their beautiful home Citrine that's been in the awards categories locally and nationally. And we were talking about using the metaphor or the analogy about a home as a giant art installation, and how you would look at an art installation and how you could build a home along the similar lines and vice versa. And at the Toy Gallery, what they've got is a bundle of island architects, architects from Waiheke Island, displaying some of the plans and models, really looking at the art aspect of architecture. It's a really interesting idea. And I think as part of that too, if I understand it correctly, they've also arranged with some house owners who have got some architecturally stunning homes to be able to visit those as well as part of the exhibition. I think I've got that right, but it's worth checking out. Definitely get into the Toy Gallery and have a look at that. Now, I mentioned at the start of the show about an interview with author Stefan Hessel. Now, At Tivoli, 3 o'clock on Saturday, there's the release of the super-selling pamphlet-style book called Time for Outrage that Stefan is the author of. Now, I'll just read you this quote from Stefan. "You must find the things that you will not accept that will outrage you. And these things you must be able to fight against non-violently, peacefully, but determinedly." And he wrote this pamphlet. Well, he's going to tell you all about it, so I'm not going to go there. But the book sold more than 3.5 million copies worldwide. It's been translated into 10 languages, and it's not been out that long. Several more languages are planned. Copies are going on sale at Tivoli at 3 o'clock this Saturday as a commemoration of Basil Holmes. The reason for that is because Basil had encouraged Liz to actually get copies into her shop, which she's finally managed to have them arrive, and they're there. So what you're going to hear is a conversation that was on Democracy Now. It was done by the Democracy Now organization. It's a conversation with the author, Stefan Hessel, and it's about the his book and his fascinating life. He's 93 now, but it's just where he's got to. And I swear, when I was listening to this, it was like there were moments when it was like listening to Basil with a French accent. It was phenomenal. So some of this interview I'll actually be hearing for the first time. Now, I wouldn't usually do this on a live show, but the opportunity to play this was just too good to miss. So let's just enjoy this conversation with Stefan Hessel.
As protest encampments take root here in New York with a movement to occupy Wall Street, drawing inspiration from the Arab Spring in Egypt and the protests in Spain, we turn to one of the people whose work has helped inspire those uprisings, Stefan Hessel. Stefan Hessel's new pamphlet-length book became a publishing sensation soon after it was released last October. Time for Outrage has sold more than 3.5 million copies worldwide. Stefan Hessel has occupied many positions in his life: immigrant, French resistance fighter, concentration camp survivor, diplomat, advocate, and author. Stefan Hessel was born in Berlin in 1917 and arrived in France at the age of 7. He joined the French resistance during the Second World War and was caught by the Gestapo and sent to the Buchenwald concentration camp. He escaped during transfer to Bergen-Belsen. He subsequently helped to draft the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights and became an honorary ambassador of France, appointed to special government missions. He has since been a fierce advocate of the rights of the Palestinian people. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Delighted to be with you this morning.
This book that has sparked such huge popularity all around the world for the ideas in it. It's a very short book, Time for Outrage. Tell us, why did you decide to write it, and have you been surprised by the response?
Very much surprised. When I first asked editor, Indigène edition of Montpellier, to publish a little pamphlet, a little appeal, I thought it would hark back to the French resistance, and that the movement of the French resistance brought up some basic values which they consider fundamental, and they wanted General de Gaulle to apply when the war would be over. These values are still eminently the basic values. I found them carried forward by an American president for whom I have the greatest admiration and respect, Franklin Roosevelt. He was the one who allowed the Charter of the United Nations to come up. And I'm still working 66 years later to try to make those values felt by the younger generation. That is why in this small book, not very expensive, easily distributed all around, we try to say these are the values on which, if they are violated, you must protest. You must find the time for outrage when these values are not respected.
You're 94 years old now, and as you were telling me earlier, you were born during the Russian Revolution.
Exactly.
And in terms of the key lessons that you are trying to impart to this extraordinary resurgence that we've seen of young people around the country, from around the world, from Tahrir Square to Spain to England, and now even here to the United States with Occupy Wall Street. What are the main lessons from your time that you are trying to impart to the young people?
I think we have had the possibility of living in democracies. What does it mean? It means places where the privileged are not the one to make the decisions, but that the underprivileged are going to rise to a status where they are normal human beings and human citizens with their freedoms and their rights. When that is no longer the case, whatever the circumstance, in France with President Sarkozy, definitely, in Spain perhaps after many attempts, then it is proper for the young generation to listen to the very old ones who tell them, we have been resistors at a time where there was fascism or Stalinism. You must find the things that you will not accept, that will outrage you, and these things you must be able to fight against non-violently, peacefully, but determinedly. That is why I'm so happy about what happens these days in Wall Street, because they're indeed very peaceful. They're not throwing any bombs or any stones, but they're there determined to see that their values are to be respected.
Your years in the French resistance, as you remarked, that really the resistance really shaped the modern French Republic. And could you talk about what you did during those years and the important lessons you learned in that battle during World War II against the Nazis?
In that time, as in all other times of my life, I was extraordinarily fortunate. I managed to leave France in 1941, helped by a marvelous American young man, Varian Fry, who were there to try to get out of France people with some merit, as creative people. And he also helped me, and I joined General de Gaulle. I spent 2 years in London working in relationship with the French resistance. This was a special office in the headquarters of General de Gaulle. We worked, of course, with the British intelligence, and that lasted 2 years. And then I said, I don't want to sit in an office anymore. Please send me to France. And I organized a mission to France. Very interesting, trying to prepare for the liberation of France. And that is where I met these people, these workers of the resistance, brought together by Jean Moulin, who was an extraordinarily important person for the resistance. And they sat around and said, what are the values that we want to see implemented? Not the Vichy values, not the Nazi values, not the fascist values, but the real democratic values. Inspired by the New Deal of President Roosevelt, inspired by Beveridge of Great Britain, welfare states where the rights, social and economic rights, of the ordinary people would be respected, and they drafted that into a program. I listened to that. I was then sent, unfortunately I was captured, sent to Buchenwald, and when the war was ended, I said, now I have a responsibility. As a survivor, as one of the relatively few survivors of concentration camps, many of my comrades had died there. So I said, now I have a responsibility. I want to carry it. What is the responsibility? It is to let the values on which we have fought known to the succeeding generations. That is what I've been doing until now.
And your experiences in Buchenwald?
Buchenwald was a camp where one could survive, but of course not if one was condemned to death. I arrived there not knowing that I was condemned to be hanged, but when I heard about it, I tried to escape, and I escaped by accepting the identity of a young Frenchman who had just died of typhus. His body was sent to the crematorium under my identity, and I captured his. Quite a trick, not easy, and it was Eugen Kogon, a great German activist, who managed this thing. And that is when I was sent to another camp. From that other camp, I escaped. I was recaptured after 5 hours and sent to one of the worst camps, Dora, where the V1, V2 were being built. and where the unfortunate häftlinge were working under conditions that were hardly survivable. I, again, was fortunate. I stayed there only a month and a half, and when I escaped, I managed to join the American Army in Hanover. And they said, "Who are you?" "I'm a concentration camp inmate." "Well, where could you come from? Do you know anybody in France?" I said, "Well, I know General de Gaulle." "Oh," they said, "all right, well, you work with us." And so I ended the war with an American uniform.
And the impact that of the resistance in terms of the government of France afterwards and the social policies of France, and how do you see the move backward of the current French government?
That is what I'm worried about. I think the 31st years after the war, the French democracy was solid, and there were problems like everywhere, but at least we knew what values we were up to. After the election of Chirac and now of Sarkozy, I find that these values are no longer really, really present, and that lobbies, not only in France but in many other countries, lobbies of the financial, capitalistic, unregulated powers, they weigh on our governments and make them lead ways, for instance, against immigration, for instance, school systems being kept back for reasons, budgetary reasons. All this is a line which I consider extremely dangerous, because it will gradually bring the powers of finance to exercise an overriding power, and democracy will be only a dream and not a reality.
And you mentioned immigration. It's the anti-immigrant fervor that swept all of the advanced West here in the United States against Latinos and Caribbeans, France against Algerians and Moroccans and Tunisians, and England against Pakistanis and Jamaicans and Indians. Your sense of the impact of this hysteria in terms of the unity of the peoples of those countries?
Yes, I think the word security is one of the most dangerous words that can be used by governments. They say, for reasons of security, we cannot accept this, we cannot do that, we cannot do the other. Security is all right, but freedom is even more important. What did we learn in the concentration camps? We learned solidarity, living together. It was really a place where Europe was born, because so many Europeans of different nationalities were together in these camps. And they knew that what they wanted was good not only for one country, but it was good for Europe as a whole. So I was glad that Europe was indeed, it was a great moment for Europe these last 100 years, but we are still not sufficiently federalized in Europe to be strong enough. And now when something comes up like the Near East problem with Palestine and the Israeli, we are not in a position to really exert important pressure. And that is why I feel much has to be done by the younger generation.
And your book specifically says that there the two principal problems that you see are the growing income inequality in the world, and of course, obviously, right now in Europe, there's the huge financial crisis, and the people are being made to pay while the banks are being bailed out, and also the violation of human rights and national rights around the world. Could you talk about both of those?
That is, to my mind, one of the gravest challenges, and that challenge is really a worldwide challenge. That is why I'm happy to work with a group called the Ethical International Collegium, of which Michel Rocard of France is one of the chairmen. What do we think? We think these challenges, the one that you just described, human rights and extreme poverty, and of course the other great challenge of the Earth, the planet, which is being overexploited. We must bring people together with government experience and others with philosophical experience, and have them work together to change the way in which we look into the future.
Absolutely fascinating stuff. And there's more which you'll be able to get hold of off the website www.waihikiradio.org.nz. Just stimulating stuff. So his book, Stefan Hessel's book, Time for Outrage, will be on release on the island at Tivoli Bookstore. That's in Ocean View Road on Eroa, 3 o'clock on Saturday, and it's part of a commemoration for Basil Holmes, as Basil was instigator along with Liz of actually getting copies onto the island. So it's absolutely worth getting down there for that. And that's about us for the show this week. Podcast will be up later on this evening, and I'll actually put that Stefan Hessel conversation up there as a separate podcast. You can get that as well, www.waihikiradio.org.nz. Just have a look at the podcast area, right-hand side of the screen. Artist Goldsmith, thank you so much. That's to Dave and Christine for sponsoring the show, looking after us. You'll find them at Studio Connections, Ocean View Road on Eroa. And I'm going to leave you with our final episode of Jaws, the serialization of the Jaws book. Remember, it is a fairly graphic telling of the book, so it's not one for the kids. It's not actually one for me. I have to sit here with the fingers in my ears because it gives me the wobblies, and I'm looking forward to going swimming over the summer, maybe even over the weekend, you never know. Anyway, here comes Jaws 6. Until next week, bye now.
It took Brody's eyes a moment to adjust, but then he saw the fin. A ragged, brownish-gray triangle that sliced through the water, followed by the scythe tail sweeping left and right with short, spasmodic thrusts. The fish was at least 30 yards behind the boat, Brody guessed. Maybe 40.
You sure it's him? He said.
It's him,
said Quint.
Let's put the cage overboard, said Hooper.
Hooper removed his shirt, sneakers, and trousers and began to pull the neoprene diving suit over his legs. When he was dressed, Hooper fitted the regulator onto the neck of the air tank and opened the air valve. He sucked two breaths from the tank to make sure it was feeding air.
Help me put this on, will you? He said to Brody.
Brody lifted the air tank and held it while Hooper slipped his arms through the straps and fastened a third strap around his middle. Hooper stopped himself before he hit the bottom of the cage. He reached out to the hatch at the top of the cage and pulled it closed.
I guess we can let go, said Brody.
They released the ropes and let the cage descend until the hatch was about 4 feet beneath the surface. The only sounds Hooper could hear were those he made breathing. He turned around and looked up at the hull of the boat, a gray body that sat above him, bouncing slowly. He looked for the fish. Even with the bright sunlight, the visibility in the murky water was poor, no more than 40 feet. He glanced downward. Rising at him from the darkling blue, slowly, smoothly, was the shark. Hooper stared, enthralled, impelled to flee but unable to move. The fish came closer, silent as a shadow, and Hooper drew back. The head was only a few feet from the cage when the fish turned and began to pass before Hooper's eyes. Casually, as if in proud display of its incalculable mass and power. The snout passed first, then the jaw, slack and smiling, and then the black, fathomless eye, seemingly riveted upon him.
What the hell is he doing down there? Said Brody. Why didn't he jab him with the gun?
Quint didn't answer. He stood on the transom, harpoon clutched in his fist. Through the viewfinder of his camera, Hooper saw the fish turn towards him. Hooper raised his right hand to change the focus. Remember to change it again, he told himself, when it turns. But the fish did not turn. A shiver traveled the length of its body as it closed on the cage. It struck the cage head on, the snout ramming between two bars and spreading them. The snout hit Hooper in the chest and knocked him backward. The camera flew from his hands and the mouthpiece shot from his mouth. The fish turned on its side, and the pounding tail forced the great body farther into the cage. Hooper groped for his mouthpiece, but couldn't find it. His chest was convulsed with the need for air.
It's attacking!
Screamed Brody. He grabbed one of the tether ropes and pulled, desperately trying to raise the cage.
God damn your soul! Quint shouted. Gotta get him on the surface! Come up, you devil!
The fish slid backward out of the cage and turned sharply to the right in a tight circle. It was then that Hooper saw the wide gap in the bars and saw the giant head lunging through it. He raised his hands above his head, grasping at the escape hatch. The fish rammed through the space between the bars, spreading them still farther with each thrust of its tail. Hooper, flattened against the back of the cage, saw the mouth reaching, straining for him. The fish thrust again, and Hooper saw, with the terror of doom, that the mouth was going to reach him. The jaws closed around his torso. Hooper felt a terrible pressure, as if his guts were compacted. He jabbed his fist into the black eye. The fish bit down. And the last thing Hooper saw before he died was the eye gazing at him through a cloud of his own blood. "He's got him!" cried Brody. "Do something!"
"That man is dead," Quint said.
"How do you know? We may be able to save him."
"He's dead."
"It's coming up," said Brody.
"Grab the rifle!"
Quint cocked his hand for the throw. The fish broke water 15 feet from the boat, surging upward in a shower of spray. Hooper's body protruded from each side of the mouth, head and arms hanging limply down one side, knees, calves, and feet from the other. Brody reached for the rifle, and Quint cast the harpoon. The target was huge, a field of white belly, and the distance was not too great for a successful throw above water. But as Quint threw, the fish began to slide down in the water, and the iron went high. For another instant, the fish remained on the surface, its head out of the water, Hooper hanging from its mouth.
"Shoot!" Quint yelled. "For God's sake, shoot!"
Brody shot without aiming. The first two shots hit the water in front of the fish. The third, to Brody's horror, struck Hooper in the neck. The fish might never have been there. The water was calm. The only difference was that Hooper was gone.
"What do we do now?" said Brody.
"What in the name of God can we do now?"
Quint said, "I don't think we'll have to wait that long."
He uncovered a sheep he had been saving for bait, tied a rope around its neck, and lay it on the gunwale. He slashed its stomach and flung the animal overboard, letting it drift 20 feet from the boat before securing the rope to an after cleat.
"Okay, now let's see how long it takes."
The sky had lightened to full gray daylight, and in ones and twos, the lights on the shore flicked off. Brody's butt was sore from sitting on the hard transom. Suddenly, he saw the monstrous head of the fish not 5 feet away. So close he could reach over and touch it. Black eyes staring at him, silver-gray snout pointing at him, gaping jaw grinning at him.
"Oh, God," Brody said.
"There he is!" Quint was down the ladder and at the stern in an instant. As he jumped onto the transom, the fish's head slipped back into the water, and a second later, slammed into the transom. The jaws closed on the wood, and the head shook violently from side to side. Brody grabbed a cleat and held on, unable to look away from the eyes. The boat shuddered and jerked each time the fish moved its head. Quint slipped and fell to his knees on the transom. The fish let go and dropped beneath the surface, and the boat lay still again.
"He was waiting for us," said Brody.
"It don't matter," said Quint. "We got him now."
"We've got him. Did you see what he did to the boat?"
"Give it a mighty good shake, didn't he?"
The rope holding the sheep tightened, shook for a moment, then went slack. Quint stood and picked up the harpoon.
"He's took the sheep."
The dorsal fin and tail surfaced 10 yards to the right of the stern and began to move again towards the boat.
"There you come," said Quint. "There you come!"
He stood, legs spread, left hand on his hip, right hand extended to the sky, grasping the harpoon. When the fish was a few feet from the boat and heading straight on, Quint cast his iron. The harpoon struck the fish in front of the dorsal fin. Quint jumped to his feet and cried,
"Got ya, you devil!"
The boat lurched once and again, and there was the distant sound of crunching.
"Has he done any damage?" said Brody.
"Some. We're riding a little heavy aft. He probably poked a hole in us. There's nothing to worry about. We'll pump her out."
"That's it then," Brody said happily.
"Not quite. Look."
"He's chasing us?"
Quint nodded.
"Why?"
He can't still think we're food.
No, he means to make a fight of it, and it's a fight he'll get.
He picked up the harpoon. Excitement had returned to his face.
Okay, he called. Come and get it.
Brody saw the flat plane of gray pass along the starboard side of the boat, 6 feet beneath the surface.
He's here, heading forward.
The fish hit the bow head-on with a noise like a muffled explosion. Quint cast his iron. It struck the fish atop the head over the right eye, and it held fast.
What do you think? Is he dead?
I doubt it, but he may be close enough to it for us to throw a rope round his tail and drag him till he drowns.
Quint took a coil of rope from one of the barrels in the bow. He tied one end to an after cleat. The other end he tied into a noose. He climbed onto the gunwale, ran the rope through a pulley at the top of the gin pole and down the pole to the winch. He flipped the starter switch. As soon as the slack in the rope was taken up, the boat heeled hard to starboard, dragged down by the weight of the fish.
Can that winch handle him? Said Brody.
Suddenly, the rope started coming too fast. It fouled on the winch, coiling in snarls. The boat snapped upright.
Rope break? Damn it, no,
said Quint. And now Brody saw fear in his face.
Damn fish is coming up!
He dashed to the controls and threw the engine into forward. But it was too late. The fish broke water right beside the boat. It rose vertically, and in an instant of horror, Brody gasped at the size of the body. The fish landed on the stern of the boat with a shattering crash, driving the boat beneath the waves. Water poured in over the transom. In seconds, Quint and Brody were standing in water up to their hips. The fish lay there, its jaw not 3 feet from Brody's chest. The body twitched, and in the black eye, as big as a baseball, Brody thought he saw his own image reflected.
God damn your black soul,
screamed Quint. He grabbed the harpoon dart at the end of the rope and with his hand plunged it into the soft white belly of the fish. Blood poured from the wound and bathed Quint's hands. The boat was sinking. The stern was completely submerged and the bow was rising. The fish rolled off the stern and slid beneath the waves. The rope attached to the dart Quint had stuck into the fish followed. Suddenly, Quint lost his footing and fell backward into the water.
The knife!
He cried, lifting his left leg above the surface, and Brody saw the rope coiled around Quint's foot. Brody could not move fast enough. He watched in helpless terror as Quint, reaching towards him with grasping fingers, eyes wide and pleading, was pulled slowly down into the dark water. For a moment there was silence, except for the sucking sound of the boat slipping gradually under. A seat cushion popped to the surface next to him, and Brody grabbed it. The water was up to Brody's shoulders, and he saw the tail and dorsal fin break the surface 20 yards away. The tail waved once left, once right, and the dorsal fin moved closer.
Get away, damn you!
The fish kept coming, barely moving. Brody clutched the cushion, and he found that by holding it in front of him and kicking constantly, he could stay afloat without exhausting himself. The fish came closer. It was only a few feet away, and Brody could see the conical snout. He screamed, an ejaculation of hopelessness, and closed his eyes, waiting for an agony he could not imagine. Nothing happened. He opened his eyes. The fish was nearly touching him, only a foot or two away, but it had stopped. And then, as Brody watched, the steel-gray body began to recede downward into the gloom. Brody put his face into the water and opened his eyes. Through the stinging saltwater mist, he saw the fish sink in a slow and graceful spiral, trailing behind it the body of Quint, arms out to the sides, head thrown back, mouth open in mute protest. The dead fish faded from view, and Quint's body hung suspended, a shadow twirling slowly in the twilight. Brody raised his head, cleared his eyes, and sighted in the distance the black point of the water tower. Then he began to kick toward shore. Jaws by Peter Benchley, read by John Garasio, and abridged and directed by John Taylor, was a Fiction Factory production.